Okay, today I'm in London with Nick Leeson. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us, Nick. Now, I've interviewed several gamblers in the course of this series, but it's safe to say that you were the biggest. You have a whole new life now. Do the days of Baring Bank seem like someone else?
No, I mean, I talk about my experiences around the world these days, so I don't think I can ever distance myself from it. So, and you've got to learn lessons, you know. It was unchecked risk-taking, doing a lot of stupid things, so you kind of take that period of time and try to learn from it and make yourself better out of it. And if there were some behaviours that were a little bit out of control, learn how to curb those. And I think any form of gambling or investing, you know, there's always that age-old adage between whether working in the financial markets is gambling or whether it's informed investment. But there, you know, a lot of the things that go on in both are very, very similar.
Okay, now you came from a working class background. At the time, it's quite unusual for somebody from your background to get into banking. What attracted you to it?
Well, for me, coming from a council house in Watford, my mum was always looking for me to achieve more than she had in her lifetime, and have a more stable career and something that was going to be a job for life, I suppose, was the thing that we used to look back at on those days of the late 70s, early 80s. And banking was one of those things. I kind of disproved that theory over the years, I suppose.
Okay, then, remembering back to those days, and also just sort of the footage of Rogue Trader, assuming it was fairly accurate, the trading floors at the time seemed an awful lot like the betting rings on racecourses at the time as well. A lot of business done with hand signals, tic-tac and racing, and, you know, word of mouth. Can you do us a fictitious deal with hand signals?
Oh, I'm sure I can remember a few. I mean, it's. I mean, the hand signals are quite simple. If you hold your hand out with your palm facing away from you, you're trying to buy something. If you face it towards people, you're looking to sell something. So it's quite simple. You're either looking to unload something or you're looking to buy something. Different prices, and then you use your face for the quantity. So, you know, one, two. It's fairly simple stuff, and I suppose it is. You know, its beginnings start with a similar sort of thing to what used to go on in the on the tic-tac side of it. Those markets are few and far between these days. I mean, they've all been, they're all now automated. They're all, you know, run by big technology companies. And the idea there is to take some of the abnormal practices that may have gone on during that time out of the market, and being fully automated is one way of doing that.
Yeah, there's one thing that wouldn't have happened more than once on the race course. That is if a workman made a mistake.
Sure.
But the whole Baring sort of saga started when you try to protect a colleague, an experienced colleague that made a rick.
Yeah.
I mean, how prevalent were mistakes in those days in general?
Yeah, I mean, especially on an open outcry market, they're a daily occurrence. So, you know, the thing is, and it's as true today as it was 20, 30 years ago, you know, if somebody does make an error, the thing is that you need to identify it as quickly as possible and rectify it. Just if somebody, you know, wrote a bet down incorrectly on the rails or something, and it's identifying it quickly and making sure that you remedy the situation as quickly as possible. So it was a daily occurrence.
Were you ever into horse racing when you were in England? Were you ever on the race course?
Horse racing for me was always an entertainment sport rather than something that I looked to get involved in on the betting perspective. I have quite a simple philosophy. You know, I think if you have a team sport or you have even an individual sport, where are humans involved, you can have an insight into what their mindset is, how their you know, what their form is over a period of time. You know, me logically, when I'm trying to transpose that onto a horse, it doesn't work for me. You know, I can't work out whether a horse has had a good night's sleep or it's, you know, it's on its game or it's doing things. So I wasn't really into studying the form of horses. So for me, I started work at Coutts, and they would, you know, once or twice a year there'd be an outing to Sandown or Ascot, but it was more of a team building thing. And whilst there, definitely have a bet. I live in Galway now. Obviously they have the festival every year. You know, I might attend one day out of the 7 days racing, but have been involved or have been around betting over a number of years. I mean, Paddy Power is a friend of mine, you know, I set up or was the face of their first steps into the online betting markets, I think, in 2000. So I gave some interviews around the launch of that.
Okay, now you mentioned in the Rogue Trader that you were placing bets, I think it's for a guy named Simon Jones, when your boss is there. Was there a big betting culture in the banking business over in Singapore in the Far East?
I don't think necessarily it's something that you would ascribe to the banking industry. I think the trading floors are very different. You know, if you look at Life back in the UK, or if you look at Cymex at the time, everybody's looking for an edge. So there's certain things certain events that people would almost trade around. So a couple of examples would be the World Cup. So this was, so if you think of my time in the UK before I left to go to Singapore, in 1992. I was in Singapore in 92 to 95. So there were a few spread betting firms that were coming up or just starting at the time. The majority of them were doing financial betting on where the markets were gonna either finish out that day or settle at a specific time of day. But there was also a lot of markets on the World Cup, football matches, and the Asians are very much, I mean, you have Asian handicaps these days, so there's, the Asians are very much into that. They all follow the Premier League and other matches. But one of the things around the World Cup that was very big, both on Life and in Singapore, and I'm sure a couple of other markets as well, was the total number of goals. So you'd have a bid and an offer or a spread between those two markets. So I can't remember how many teams were in the World Cup back in the 90s, but it was fewer than now. So I think the market used to be about 128 to 130, and it traded almost like a future. So that's why there was this synergy with those two particular markets. So you could buy at one price and sell at another. And just take a profit on the movement between it. So if it was mispriced, you had a couple of big games with, there were some new teams coming into the World Cup around that time, who maybe were getting on the wrong side of a couple of bad results. But the similarity was that it traded like a future and the market moved quite similar. So in Asia or in Singapore at the time, they would always want a price on what the total goals market was going to be. Somebody would be able to access that in London, be that me, and you could make your own market, which was a little bit wider than what you were getting from the spread betting firms, and give yourself a degree of comfort if you needed to hedge it out at any time. So it was more intertwined with the financial markets than taking a bet on a horse per se.
Yeah. Now going back to the bearings thing that's, you know, that's famous for, you got really into it deep with the 5/8 account.
Yeah.
And then you got out of it. You managed to bet your way out.
In May of 93, yeah.
Why did you not think, thank God for that, and close the lid on it?
Well, look, I definitely did. And, you know, it occurred on the expiry of an option on a Friday afternoon. And I had money, I'd made money rather than, and I'd recouped all of the losses and I'd actually made money. And over the course of that weekend, there's a degree of celebration, and you know, this is never going to happen again. But I think, you know, lack of management skills in the preceding period, all of the people who worked for me on the trading floor who took the orders were still making mistakes on the Monday afternoon, and I very stupidly put them back in. Now, there's probably a whole host of reasons that you can come up for that in terms of, you know, not wanting to highlight an error at that stage because people might have looked back at what had gone on before. You know, the fact that you've managed to get out of the situation once so that you think that you're going to be able to do it again. So there were a whole host of things that were influencing that. Whether you do it, I think a lot of what went on during that time when you look back at it was subconscious rather than conscious, you know, whereas I should have been a little bit stronger, a little bit more resolute and said, you know, that's it, we're not doing this, close down the account, just as you would do with a betting website if you've got a gaming problem, and be done with it. But, you know, gamble aware or whatever they're called weren't around at that stage.
Now, simplistically, if I've got my facts right, you were then sort of doubling up to try and get back.
There's lots of different analogies that come to the fore. What it was for me, and maybe this won't come across in the right way, it's more of a cash play. I needed cash. And the reason why you need cash is to be able to keep the balance in the 5/8 account at zero. So you need premium, which is what you receive when you sell options. And in Singapore at the time, they paid you 100% of the premium. So for me, when I look back at it, because it's not a pure gambling analogy or terminology, what I was doing was I was swapping a P&L item for a balance sheet item. If you look at it from a very superficial perspective, it is doubling down. And in terms of how the position changed, it's just getting dynamically bigger as the markets are moving against you. So there's different ways of looking at it, but you know, I understand the gambling or doubling down analogy, and it's definitely the way that it looks. But that wasn't necessarily, you know, it wasn't me a case of me thinking, okay, you know, I've got 100 lots that are against me, and if I sell another 100 lots, it's only got to move back half the position, which is the traditional way that you would think of doubling down. For me, it was in order to secrete this account, I need to keep the account balance at zero, which means that I need to sell another 100 options to bring that account balance down to zero. In the meantime, that doubles the position, but that wasn't the, you know, that wasn't the thought process, if that is understandable.
Yeah, I mean, because I was going to say, because casinos and bookie empires are funded on people following increasing staking systems. So as you sort of, you're looking for a small arbitrage margin, is it not quite as foolhardy as it sounds to try that strategy?
Well, it wasn't a strategy that I was using. It's funny, wherever I go in the world and I'm talking about things, you know, you often get asked is, what was the strategy that you were using? There wasn't a strategy. The strategy was, I needed cash to make the account balance zero, so that would be secreted on the balance sheet, that the checks would be, that you would be able to overcome those checks. You know, nobody had asked any more questions during that period. So in the process, what happens is your exposure doubles.
Okay, at the end, it must have been unbearable pressure, and you kind of slept at night. I mean, was it almost a relief when it all blew up and you got caught?
You're kind of always, from day one, you're waiting for somebody to knock on the door and expose what's going on. And, you know, as time passes and people aren't knocking on the door or asking you a question about, you know, why the position is mounting or why this doesn't agree or why that doesn't agree, you garner a bit more confidence that you have more time to correct the situation. And there was, you know, I was certainly looking to just get as much time as possible in order to be able to solve the situation. So, you know, in 95, which was the year of the collapse, you're holding on for different things. Bonuses are about to be paid. My wife's got some friends visiting, none of which make any sense when you look back at it. But, you know, when you're in the moment and you don't want to expose your own failure, and you can't enunciate what's going on, you're kind of waiting for that event to be taken out of your hands, which it was in February 1995.
Okay, Nick, so in part when you sort of eventually got caught, you were sentenced to 6 years?
Six and a half,
and you served?
4 years and 4 months.
4 years. How were conditions in a Singapore prison?
They're tough, but you know, it's like anything. You can't, after you've done the crime, you can't be complaining about it. So you know where you are, you know what you're doing, you know you shouldn't be doing it. You get caught, you're rightly punished. So between the English and Singaporean authorities, they decided that Singapore was the appropriate place for me to go to trial. So, you know, I was sentenced to 6.5 years in prison in Singapore. The standard remission is a third, so I did 4 years in 4 months. I got time off for the time that I spent in Frankfurt, which was about 8.5 months. So spent, you know, 3.5 years, I suppose, in prison in Singapore. The conditions are tough. You're locked up for 23 hours a day. You sleep on the floor. The floor is very rough and uneven. Everybody, absolutely everybody in Singapore prison is a triad gang member. So there's a gang culture that you need to adhere to. You need to understand it. You need to give face to the people that are in there. If you don't, you're going to find it really tough. And you know, there were a couple of Westerners towards the end of my time in Singapore who came into the prison and didn't grasp that concept, and you know, they got beat up on a fairly regular basis. And you know, my UK gang was a gang of one, so you know, I wasn't able to offer any protection to those particular people. So you need to understand it, understand the culture. Obviously, I'd been in Singapore for a long time before that. I'd lived in Asia for an even longer period, so knew how to behave. And knowing how to behave was the key part of surviving in prison. But you know, there were punch-ups. There's three people to a cell. A cell is 6 foot by 9 foot. As I said, you sleep on the floor. It's very rough and uneven. You eat rice twice a day, which to a European palate is very, very difficult. But you have to work out how you get around things and survive.
Did you strike up any special friendships that you've kept up since you left?
No. I mean, I didn't go to prison to make friends. So you talk to people to get by. You know, you don't want to be a recluse. So you, the Chinese inmates tended to be very poorly educated, so you didn't really spend too much time with the Chinese. The Malay and Indians tended to have better English. So I used to spend more time with the Malay inmates. So you'd exercise and you'd get by and you'd pad out your time when you did have any free time. But making friends, no, that wasn't the, not that I intended to go to prison, but that certainly wasn't the intention whilst I was in prison.
Okay, now you say you weren't there to make friends, but it would be quite easy to make enemies. Did you ever feel in any danger, real serious danger? From the other inmates?
Violence in Singaporean prisons are really strictly controlled. They're very, you know, they're run along army guidelines. As I said, there's lots of gangs, and you know, one gang sits in one area, another gang sits in another area, and you don't transgress those areas. So, and that's part of the behaviour and understanding what goes on. There was violence, and if there is violence, it's very, it's brutal. It's very quick, but it's over equally quick as well, because they have commando guards who are on standby. They have big sticks, full riot gear, and so when there is trouble or a disturbance, they put it down equally violently. So I estimated that if you got into a fight, you needed to survive for somewhere between 60 and 90 seconds, at which time the guards would have stopped everything that was going on. You know, there's CCTV camera everywhere, so you can't, you know, it's not going to go undetected. There's nowhere to hide away from the surveillance. I used to kickbox when I worked in London, so I used to kickbox down on Judge Street with a Spanish world champion. So if need be, I can have a row. There was only one occasion where I needed to do that in Singapore. And I suppose this is something you hear about. I don't hear about from a lot of people, but you kind of understand it from what goes on a few TV programs and the such like. If you let people take advantage, they would continue to take advantage. So the one occasion that I did have a punch up in Singapore was with one of the biggest Malay. He was the head of the Malay gang. He was also the biggest physically. But you're still a little bit smaller than me, and like I say, you only have to last for 60 seconds, and you know, I'm well able to do that.
One thing you were in danger from was cancer. Yeah. How close a call was that?
Oh, extremely. I mean, in 98, I spent some time in the punishment cells for refusing to change my inmates, refusing to change the cellmates that I had because they were getting on. usually what used to happen is after somewhere between 1 and 30 days, there'd be a punch up. They'd move the two cellmates out and bring two more in. On this particular occasion, there was a couple of Malays who were in the cell with me. They shared a religion, they didn't share a gang. And they were getting on, so there was no reason to change them, but the superintendent wanted to do that. I refused to do it. So they put me in the punishment cells. I was there for 31 days. Punishment cells are a degree worse. You get your food through a cat flap in the door. You're locked up all day long. They turn the light on during the day. They turn the light on at night, they turn it off during the day. So there's a certain amount of sensory deprivation. So I lost a lot of weight whilst I was in there. Punishment for if you commit a minor offence is you go to the punishment cells for 3 days. Major offence you go for 7. I went for 31 days. Nobody came near the cell during that particular period other than the guy who was delivering the food. And then after 31 days, they told me that I had to leave. The British vice consul was there. And that was the reason why they let me out of the punishment cell. And then I'd lost a lot of weight. My eyes were bloodshot. I was experiencing a lot of pain in my stomach. So I went to see the doctor inside the prison. He eventually decided that I was anemic, that my iron blood cell count was low. But what now when I exercised, because I was sleeping on the floor or sat on the floor, when you got up, I was getting very dizzy. So I started to worry about the symptoms, and I was 31 years of age at the time, quite fit and doing an awful lot of exercise, and found it really strange. Was taking iron tablets for a period of time. They weren't really doing anything for me. So eventually I refused to take the iron tablets, gave those back to the doctor, and he sent me to a prison outside of a hospital outside of the prison. And the doctor immediately felt a lump. It was 10 centimeters by 7 centimeters. It was Duke's grade B. It was Duke's grade C. It was about to become Duke's grade B because it was going to break through the colon wall. And then it's really just about, you know, how long they can preserve your life for rather than actual recovery. So it was very, very close. And it was an emergency operation. My lung collapsed. And they operated on me in the afternoon, August 1998. So 21 years ago.
All right. So you wrote your book, Rogue Trader, while you were in prison?
I wrote the book Rogue Trader whilst I was in prison in Germany.
Yes, oh, right, okay. So what were your hopes for the future when you wrote it?
When I wrote it, my future was very uncertain because I was going back to Singapore. The reason for writing the book is I had massive legal costs. I had a lawyer in the UK, I had a lawyer in Germany, and I had a lawyer in Singapore that all needed to be paid for. So the book and the advance on the book was the methodology by which they were paid for. I think my legal fees over the year and a half that I was in prison in Germany and the handover to Singapore were in excess of £1.5 million.
So since you've been released, you've done very well. You got married again, you've got three kids. So has it panned out how you'd have hoped back in those days?
I don't think, everything was very short term in terms of how I used to approach things and look forward. You know, I was coming back to, a very uncertain period in the UK. I had health issues to contend with as well. So it was always only ever a case of looking 3 months into the future. So, you know, it's panned out well. I've been really lucky. I don't think everybody is as lucky as me coming back from a prison sentence. That upsets some people. I live my life fairly simply. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion, as too am I. You know, if I get an opportunity to earn money speaking at an event or whatever I may do, I'll take it. You know, it's the number of opportunities afforded me are probably greater than anybody else or a lot of people. Probably won't include Jeffrey Archer on the list, but I get a lot of opportunity, and I work out which ones are right, which ones are more appropriate. So and then take advantage of those.
Now you're sort of playing it down, but you must have had very good frame of mind to be able to galvanise yourself into getting back onto your feet once you got out?
It's you kind of when you first released from prison, especially coming back from Singapore, and there's a lot of media interest, you have an initial choice, and that initial choice is you face what you did and you try to overcome, or you hide away. So you know, it's quite a simple decision, and some people decide to just melt away into the background and never be seen again. You know, for me, I spent 4 years in prison looking at what I did, trying to understand it, try and look at the way that I would maybe have perhaps preferred to react, and you know, try to make changes in that regard. But you know, we all enjoy life. You've got a second opportunity. You know, for me, it was about grasping that with both hands and making the best that I possibly could with it. You know, was I inherently a bad person? No, I was a very, very normal person who made some really, really bad decisions continually over a period of time. And, you know, at the time, there was a systemic breakdown in terms of the controls that existed within the bank.
Nick, in the last part, you talked about your choices were to hide away or to come out. You really came out a few years back. Celebrity Big Brother, where you were actually very popular in there, finishing fourth.
Yeah.
How was that as an experience? Because, I mean, when I tell people I'm interviewing Nick Leeson,
they remember
everybody
that.
Knows who Nick Leeson is.
Yeah.
You know, for one reason or another, probably depending on their age.
Yeah.
So, you know, how was that in there, and did you enjoy the experience?
Well, I mean, for me, it was, you obviously get paid for doing it, so, you know, that was one of the reasons. It also, I suppose, after 20 or nearly 20 years, it's a good way of seeing how your development has been over that previous 20 years. Obviously, a lot of the talking events that I go to, I'm invited to, and people are specifically looking for me. So you're talking to a relevant audience. So this was a way of, you know, speaking to a wider audience in terms of, you know, who I was, who I really was, because, you know, you can go in there, as I'm sure a few people did, and they, you know, they try to put on a certain personality or a way that they try to portray themselves. But, you know, you are locked up because you can't get out, but you're locked up for about 30 days, maybe 35 days in there, if you last to the end in the Big Brother house. And you know, you can't get away from the camera, so I think you can work out who's not really being themselves, who's got certain sound bites that they want to hit every day, and you can see them ticking it off in their heads and being quite calculating about it. But it's false, and I think people, you know, eventually see through that. So, you know, those were the reasons why I did it. Did I enjoy it? It was a job of work. That was the way that I approached it. But you know, like, I'm somebody who'll observe people and, you know, not jump into stuff. And, you know, if something needs to be said, I don't have a problem saying it. But not, you know, not without being quite sure of what I want to say.
Okay, now how realistic is it that you're in there alone? I mean, do you suddenly get a camera crew wandering past, or is the producer suddenly turn up and say, come on, guys, say something? Is anything like that, or are you literally in there?
Oh, no, genuinely, you don't see anybody other than the housemates. You know, every now and again, there might be a camera change that needs to take place, and, you know, they'd be behind, dark glass panels, and you might catch, you know, if you're looking at it at the particularly right, at the right angle, and a piece of sun is glinting in at that time, you might see somebody moving around in there. But genuinely, you don't see anybody from the minute you enter until the minute you leave.
Okay, now going back to Barings Bank, have you ever bumped into any of the top brass since then?
Yeah,
How was that? How was the reaction to you?
It's always, you know, I suppose it's a little bit different. I've met Peter Norris, who was the CIO of Barings. I was at an event in Luxembourg, and Miles Rivet-Carnac, who used to be the number two in all of Baring Brothers, was at those particular events. It's, you know, I think in some ways it's probably more difficult for them, because they, you know, my incompetence and negligence throughout that period in Singapore is part of folklore these days. You know, they don't want to have to revisit their own incompetence, negligence and stupidity during that period. And meeting me is one way that they have to do that, because, you know, as much as I messed up during that period, so did they. And it wasn't, you know, a devious, complex situation that I was involved in. It was something that was quite basic, really crude, and should have been discovered far sooner than it did. But a lot of people were asleep on the job.
And they were very happy to, when they were winning, you know, the famous quote where it's making money isn't it easy.
But you know, that's a human trait, I think. You know, when people, I don't know if it's greed, it's just, you know, where profit is the motivation, you know, people are probably more likely to be blindsided, and, you know, they were blindsided during that period.
And what about your mates and your teammates and people that you hung around with on the trading floor in Singapore?
Well, the guys in Singapore when I was diagnosed with cancer, a few of them came to visit me, so they've all moved on. You know, they don't have to. You know, they were naive. They probably weren't quite as stupid as the senior management that existed at that time. You know, a lot of their time was spent on the trading floor. They didn't really have any of the, you know, the reporting or oversight tools that the management did. So I think the biggest criticism that you can levy at them is a bit of naivety. So they've all moved on. They're working in different areas. Some of them still in the world of banking. Some of them still working on trading floors in different part of the world. But everybody moves on.
Okay, do you ever feel any guilt that of all that money that somebody has lost?
Well, I mean, Barings was and this isn't an excuse, Barings was a charitable trust. So in terms of the, and I know some of the people that had money invested in various instruments at Barings at the time. To the best of my knowledge, they've all been repaid the money. So I think it's a bit of a myth that the Queen and certain other people lost money. The Barings family certainly did. You know, you can't ever remove yourself from the guilt of doing that. You know, the traditional way, I suppose, of doing that is through being remorseful. You do that for a period of time, but then you have to kick on with life. You know, you get a second opportunity, you have to take it. And you know, if somebody still needs me 25 years on to be walking around saying, woe is me, I'm sorry, it's not going to happen. So you kind of, you know, the judge doesn't give you a sentence for remorse, he gives you a sentence to go for prison. I genuinely think I've been truly remorseful over a period of time. I don't think you can ever excuse yourself of the guilt if you're truly responsible and accountable for your actions. So I don't think that ever goes away. But you know, there's nothing, unfortunately, that I can do to change it at this point.
Well, a lot of what you've done since is all about, well, I would say sort of giving a bit back, really. You've written a book, Back from the Brink, Coping with Stress. Can you tell us a bit about that?
It was just, you know, I went through the majority of life's stressful events in a fairly short period of time. So it was just a case of, you know, showing the way that I coped with things. I coincidentally had a discussion with somebody just 10 days ago over the internet, where he, you know, is experiencing some problems and he can't confess to everybody around him about what's going on. He, you know, he just layers one lie with another lie, and you know, he was looking for a copy of the book, which I sent him. And you know, I said, look, you know, that sometimes it may look like the hardest thing, but you know, just being honest is going to put you in a better situation. You know, just get it out of the way and then deal with the ramifications afterwards. And I think, you know, those that are closest and dearest to you will rally round and help you through it. I think he is bordering with a, you know, do I jump off the cliff type of analogy. And you know, I don't think anything's worth that.
Okay, now like today you're speaking later to a group, was it banking business people?
Yeah.
So are you warning them about the potential perils of?
No, it's. I mean, this conference is very industry specific, and you know, it, for me, what I do is tell stories, and it's a story that, you know, people in the room will know well. It'll be a slightly different approach to it, so it won't be the textbook approach. It'll be more human interest, and it'll be a personal account of what went on during that period. It's very honest and candid. It's not designed to put me in a better light. I don't do that. I'm, you know, as I've mentioned previously, fully responsible for what went on during that period and my actions.
Okay, now I read that you still dabble in stocks and shares.
Yeah, it's difficult to leave it alone. It's you know, like we've spoken a little bit about gambling today, and you know, stock markets, they're addictive, and that's what you know, that's what happens to a lot of people. So you need to understand A, that they're addictive, and that they, you know, they can very quickly get out of the patterns of behaviour can very quickly get out of control. So it's important that you know how to rein those in when those activities start to get damaging. I've had a fairly big slap in the face, or a big lesson in that during what went on at the bank. So, you know, I'm only investing my own money, and you know, I can afford to lose it if I have to, you know, it never gets to a problem stage.
Okay, just a couple more questions. This is probably going to be quite a tricky one, but had things have been different, and that you were working at Barings Bank in Singapore, the 8888 account never happened. Mm. Would your life have panned out for better or for worse if you'd stayed in that industry, do you think?
I don't know. It's one of those it's one of those questions that's you know, kind of wishful thinking. There's a certain amount of wishful thinking within it, and I try to avoid that because I think that it's quite negative, and you end up turning into a manic depressive if you spend your day thinking, I wish I did this, I wish I did that. So I really don't entertain those sort of thoughts. I think as an overall person, you know, I was very success motivated in those days. You know, it wasn't money for me. It was about getting to the top of the organisation, making all of the important decisions. Lots of different status relationships that became way too important for me. I was quite young, didn't necessarily have the management skills that were needed at that time, which led to a lot of that stupid, incorrect, whatever you want to call it, decision making. So I think, excuse me, as a whole, I think the individual, it has certainly benefited out of the experiences of the last 20 years. You know, I probably would have been some jumped up managing director of a bank that wasn't particularly well liked. I don't know. Nobody can tell, you know, but I would have been earning a fortune.
No, I know this is the final question. I know that recently your stripy blazer got flogged for a nice £3, didn't it, for charity or something?
The original years ago was sold years ago. Yeah. The original was sold for about 20 odd thousand years ago. No, there's a few of them about though. So you know, I sign a few replicas that people look for from time to time. It's, you know, it's a nice thing to have framed, and you know, it's a talking point for when people go around your house, or you know, if you've got a shed that you want to put it in or something. I don't know, but the original, or the one that went back to the liquidators, was sold to a fund manager, I think, for £22,000-£23,000, but that was a lot. Long time ago now.
What I was going to get at, if you hadn't flogged it and you had the opportunity, would you like to pull that stripey jacket back on and get back down there and have another crack at it?
Well, there's no, because it's, you know, it's a period of my life that, you know, will always be immensely embarrassing, because it's the complete opposite of what I wanted to achieve. It's also a period of my life that made me ill. So for a combination of those two reasons, you know, what I do from on the speaking side is well received. I'm as busy now, maybe even busier now than I was 20 years ago. So, you know, it's working well, and you know, it's always well received. So, and I live well.
Great stuff. Well, Nick Leeson, thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Powersports.bet provide the complete betting experience. Find us online via our website and app, on course, and at our flagship betting shop in London's Mayfair. 18 years and older only. BeGamblerAware.org.